Tonight on the Daily Debrief, a famous lawyer, a billionaire financier, and a civil suit with undertones of sexual assault involving underage girls. And questions over whether this New England man killed two family members to collect an inheritance. Plus, the case of three Chicago cops accused of covering up a murder. It's all straight ahead on the Daily Debrief for Monday, December 3rd.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Debrief. We're following several new trials this week. The first, a civil suit involving billionaire financier Jeffrey Epstein. Jury selection begins tomorrow. The case is being described as a feud between Epstein and an attorney who represented several underage women who accused Epstein of sexual assault. Some of Epstein's alleged victims are planning to testify for the first time publicly. Today, a bizarre connection involving the famous attorney Alan Dershowitz in this case. Chief investigative correspondent Brian Ross is right off the top tonight here on the Debrief with some new details about this case. So, Brian, we have Dershowitz and an editorial that we want to talk about first.
That's right. A very strong investigation by the Miami Herald has set the stage for this case, which involves Epstein, who has pleaded guilty to two counts about prostitution, nothing about sexual assault of underage girls. He might have gone to prison for life, but instead he got a sweetheart deal, serving only 13 months in a county jail. Dershowitz was one of his legal advisors, and one of the young women who alleged that she was assaulted by Epstein also said that Dershowitz had sex with her six times at the age of 16. Dershowitz erupted in fury over that and said absolutely denied it, and wrote to the Miami Herald this week in a strong letter to the editor, fully denying the allegation. This is what he said. I produced my travel, phone, credit card, and TV appearance records, conclusively proving that I could not have been and was not in any of these places during the time Roberts, Virginia Roberts, knew Epstein. He went on to say, I challenge her to repeat her false accusations out of court so that I can sue her for defamation and let a jury decide, after seeing all the evidence, including the suppressed emails and book manuscript, who is telling the truth and who is lying.
That's harsh. This is turning into a big back and forth at this point, and the particular stage of the proceeding that we're at this week hasn't even started yet.
That's right. They'll start picking the jury tomorrow. The trial will probably begin by the end of the week, expected to last about 10 days in a state court in Palm Beach, Florida. One of the things that's interesting, the reason we're so interested in Epstein, is all of his prominent friends, including President Donald Trump and former President Bill Clinton. There's no evidence they were involved, but lawyers say their names will certainly come up during the course of this trial.
I have to suspect, at least, that this is going to make jury selection really, really interesting in this case. Not only is it a high-profile individual involved in the case as a party, but attorneys are going to have to sit down with the prospective jurors and say, are you comfortable not only with this person, these accusations, and connections with high-level politicians from both parties?
Absolutely true. A lot of salacious details expected to come out during the course of this trial.
Another issue in the news we want to talk about really quickly off the top, Michael Cohen. President Trump has said he wants a long prison sentence for his former personal lawyer. Cohen wants basically nothing. What's new with him?
That's right. A bit of a tweet storm today from the President of the United States saying that Cohen is making up stories to get a great and already reduced sentence for himself. He, of course, has been cooperating with Special Counsel Robert Mueller and other prosecutors, telling all he knows, he says, about Donald Trump and what he saw as he was Trump's lawyer.
So, which side prevails here? No sentence, a long sentence, somewhere in the middle?
The lawyers for Cohen say, given the quality of his cooperation and the fact that he did so even under attack from the President of the United States, he should get no sentence at all and only pay a tax makeup for the taxes he did not pay.
I know you'll keep on top of all of these stories for us. Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross tonight.
Good to be here.
All right. On now to other cases we're preparing to cover this week here on the Law and Crime Network. One involves the suspicion of murder involving a family inheritance. Nathan Carman's aunts suspect him of playing a role in the death of his mother, Linda Carman, and his grandfather, seen here. Linda disappeared during a Rhode Island boating accident, and the grandfather was shot in the back of the head at close range. Nathan Carman hasn't been charged criminally, but his aunts believe they have at least enough evidence to block him from inheriting $7 million by getting rid of both of his relatives. The civil case is scheduled to begin tomorrow in New Hampshire. As a matter of law, a person who maliciously causes a death cannot receive money under that person's will. To Wisconsin now, where attorney and former municipal judge Len Kaczynski is scheduled to go on trial Thursday on one charge of felony stalking and two misdemeanor charges of violating a restraining order. The accusations involve his treatment of his law clerk. Kaczynski gained notoriety after his appearance in the Netflix film Making a Murderer, which chronicled his representation of Brendan Dassey, a teenager accused of murder. A judge on Friday issued an order limiting some witness testimony in the stalking case. The family of a young man gunned down at a red light in 2014 in New Jersey is speaking for the first time publicly about the case. 19-year-old Brendan Tevlin's murder made headlines in that state. Teen was shot 8 times. The killer, Ali Muhammad Brown, was the first person charged with terrorism under New Jersey state law. He pleaded guilty just before trial. He was also accused of 2 other murders in Seattle and claimed the killings were retribution for what, in his view, was U.S. military action against Muslims. Mother Allison Tevlin spoke with Law and Crime's Bob Bianchi about her son's death.
My husband was not home. He was away with my middle son, Brian, at a lacrosse tournament. So he was in Maryland. So I was home with my daughter, Michaela, and my youngest, Sean. And she had kind of been sitting with me because now we were getting worried and worried, and it was pouring. And actually, at one point, we went and drove around, and we were headed towards West Orange. Got to a certain point, and something told me to turn around. And we were probably about a mile from where there would have been a massive police presence, but got the doorbell rang, and there were several police officers there and looked very nervous, and I was just, they just said, yeah. I said, not Brendan. I said, yeah, Brendan. And they said he was murdered, and I was like I figured a car accident. And they said that, and I just honestly don't remember too much reaction, and I felt bad because Sean was, I think, 12 years old at the time, and had to call my husband in Maryland, didn't know what to say. He didn't tell Brian for the ride home. He just said something happened. He just didn't think they would make it home, I think.
Let's move on now to the case of an alleged cop cover-up in Chicago, Illinois. It all surrounds what happened in this video, which shows Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke shooting and killing a knife-wielding teenager named Laquan McDonald. One jury convicted Officer Van Dyke of second-degree murder, but now 3 other officers are on trial for that shooting. The 3 men are accused of conspiracy, official misconduct, and obstruction of justice. Prosecutors say they lied in their official reports by claiming Laquan McDonald attacked the officer who shot him. Each officer you see there has a unique defense. Testimony in this case is on hold until tomorrow, but arguments last week about the state's attempt to introduce emails from third parties riled up attorneys for each defendant. The defense attorney for Joe Walsh attacked the state's case by arguing to the judge that the state was struggling to prove a conspiracy.
Joe Walsh in the same room as these 2 other individuals, much less Jason Van Dyke, who they referred to in the indictment as Individual A. They haven't presented evidence of a phone call between Joe Walsh and any of these other alleged conspirators on the night of this event. A text message, an email. They can't put him in the room where they say this happened. And they have to do that, Judge, in order to admit this rank hearsay against Joe Walsh. All Joe Walsh did that evening, Judge, which was consistent with what we opened in this case, was he was on scene for the shooting. He did 2 reports, which you heard every witness that the state called here to testify were things that you get directed to do in these types of circumstances, and he went home. He had no more involvement with this case. He had no communication with the FOP. There's no evidence of that. He had no communication with any supervisors, whether it be lieutenants, captains, commanders who were on the scene. There's no evidence of any type of communication whatsoever that the state could even create an inference of a conspiracy that involves Joe Walsh. And I'm sure that they'll get up in response and say that we've proved it by inference. No, we can't show that there was an actual agreement. But even when they're going to offer you an inference, that inference must be reasonable, and it must be based on the evidence they presented, Judge, with all due respect. They haven't presented the evidence that they proffered to us ahead of trial that they said they were going to show you to prove the existence of the conspiracy.
David Martz said the state failed to prove his client even communicated with the other defendants.
There has been no evidence presented to this court that Detective David Martz communicated in any way, whether he's in the same room or otherwise, and in any way communicated with Officer Walsh and Officer Gaffney. In addition to that, Judge, regarding the emails the state seeks to introduce at this juncture of the trial, there is no email from David Martz, period. There is no email where David Martz is a carbon copy or a CC on it. There is no email where David Martz is even a blind carbon copy. They want to put in emails, many of them well after the fact, against David Martz and the two co-defendants. They haven't linked up that there's any agreement between these three men at all.
Gaffney said that a meeting between him and other officers involved in this case was in no way sinister. This defense attorney also fought back at attempts by the state to introduce certain emails into evidence.
That's standard operating procedure. There's nothing wrong with that. There's certainly no evidence to suggest that he participated in some conspiracy about a shooting that he did not even see. And now we have evidence that the state wishes to introduce from people my client doesn't even know. He has no connection to, and he had no knowledge of these interviews. And they're months later, after the incident, where my client no longer has any more involvement with the investigation. He's done. His only involvement in this investigation was when he was cooperating with every single in-depth investigation that followed up after this shooting. There's no evidence of any agreement at all that has been presented with regards to Thomas Gaffney.
Attorney Mike Korobanix is on the debrief tonight. Mike, good to see you again.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Okay, so these comments are part of an evidence discussion about emails. The defense doesn't want these other emails to come in because apparently their clients really weren't part of the email chain, in, at least in any relevant way. I'm assuming it was part of a hearsay argument. But look, based on what we heard, this is shaping up to be a classic defense where the attorneys are saying that the defendant's conduct just does not violate the letter of the law. Is that what we can expect in closings?
I think we've got a good preview of what to expect in closings, and that's where I think they're going. I mean, the one attorney pointed out, you know, just because the officers met and discussed things, there's nothing sinister. The word he used was sinister about it. And he's correct. I mean, this is what detectives do. They get together, they compare notes, they see what one has to say about the other thing, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense. So I think the prosecution is shaping up where they're going to have a tough road to travel in this case.
So the state is close to resting its case. We expect possibly one more witness if the judge introduces these emails. Possibly no more witnesses in the state. Does the defense even put on a defense? Does the defense even put on a case in chief after arguments like those that we just saw?
This is a difficult case because you don't usually follow the usual paradigm because you're not in front of a jury, you're in front of a judge. And I think when the way the judge rules will be the way the defense reacts. I think if she keeps the emails out, she's basically telegraphing that there's not really too much here and we don't need to go any further and I'm not going to bring anything else in. And I think if that occurs, they're probably going to gamble on not having their clients testify.
It's a bench trial. That might change how the verdict could be delivered in this case because the judge could just turn around and say, I've taken everything into advisement. I'll issue a written opinion at some point. This might not even be a situation where we're waiting for a verdict to come out from the judge's chamber.
Oh, it's such an unusual event for such serious charges. And that's right. The judge is not going to force herself into deliberations.
Exactly. Mike Korobanix will check in again with you at the end of the broadcast here. Still ahead tonight on the Daily Debrief, you'll hear the state's key witness in this cop cover-up case explain precisely where her memory of what happened deviates from the official reports. Plus, find out why this guy went berserk in a massage parlor. Our recap of some of the craziest crime headlines of the day is after the break here on the Debrief.
I'm Dan Abrams, and this is the Law and Crime Network,
the only 24/7 network with expert legal analysis and gavel-to-gavel live trial coverage.
He kissed me goodbye on the cheek. That was the last time we saw him.
From high-profile cases to the most compelling local trials.
You didn't expect
her. Let me finish.
We cover the most interesting and important legal news going on across the country.
The former officer took the stand.
And our multi-platform brand is resonating. From syndication.
With more, we're joined by Law and Crime Network host Jesse Weber.
To our expert analysis.
With me now is Rachel Stockman, editor-in-chief for Law and Crime Network.
This former head prosecutor, criminal defense attorney, and host of Law and Crime Network, Bob Bianchi.
On Monday, the Law and Crime Network covering the trial live.
Let's get to the top legal stories of the day with Jesse Weber, attorney and anchor for the Law and Crime Network. So good morning, Jesse.
With dozens of places to watch, we already have tens of millions of minutes viewed per month. And our viewers and readers are engaged with more than 30,000 comments per month on the site, a bustling chat room, and an average watch time of 30 minutes.
Womanizer, that's fine. It doesn't make me guilty of solicitation of capital murder.
In the fastest growing genre in America, we are uniquely positioned to dominate. This is Law and Crime.
You talk to me.
In every family, small conversations can make a big impact. I grew up on tour with my parents. Kind of different, but we bonded over music just like other families do over sports, camping, or other interests. And we talked. Little everyday conversations from silly to serious that built a foundation over time. Honest conversations, like when my dad shared his experiences as an alcoholic.
Your honesty about that part of your life gave me a sense of integrity that I wanted to uphold in my own life. And I was so grateful that you and Mom had become these sober, stable people who were always there for me.
I wanted you to know from someone who's been in recovery more than 30 years now that hard work is what creates success, not alcohol or other drugs, whether it's music or anything else. I said it a lot, and I'm glad you took it to heart.
Talk, they hear you. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Matthew.
I know that a lot of times, Mom, it might not seem like I'm listening to you, but I am. And what you say really does matter to me.
All the talks we've had over the years, including what you've told me about not using alcohol and other drugs, they stick with me and they make a difference, especially at times that matter most.
Hey, want a drink?
No thanks, I'm good. So thank you, Dad, for preparing me for what's ahead.
Talk, they hear you.
Everybody, time now for a check of criminal incidents in the news tonight. Here is Anthony Velez.
Here are today's top crime stories trending on LawAndCrime.com and across the country. A convicted killer is on the run after he reportedly escaped an Oklahoma jail by impersonating his cellmate. 34-year-old Patrick Walker, who was sentenced to life in prison for murder in 2003, allegedly was able to get someone to post bond for his cellmate who bared a close resemblance to him. Walker then allegedly stole his cellmate's ID and left the jail. Walker, who remains at large, is considered armed and dangerous. Christopher Watts, the Colorado man who pleaded guilty to killing his pregnant wife and two daughters, is reportedly receiving fan mail in prison, including love letters from admirers. Watts confessed to killing his wife, Shannon, and his two daughters, 4-year-old Bella and 3-year-old Celeste, in August, and was sentenced to 3 life terms in prison without the possibility of parole in November. Watts allegedly received fan letters, including photos and love letters from women, undeterred to his admitted murderous ways. Watts also received a termination letter from his employer, Anadarko Petroleum, at the Weld County Jail following his arrest. Actor Mark Hamill of the Star Wars movie franchise had a little fun on Twitter after a man bearing his famous character's name was arrested in Tennessee. The force was not with 21-year-old Luke Skywalker when he was reportedly arrested for a probation violation in connection with a felony theft charge. Hamill took to Twitter making light of the situation and even called out Walker's height with the hashtag, hashtag also too short for a stormtrooper. Walker remains at the Carter County Detention Center, held without bail. Authorities in New York City released surveillance footage of a hammer-wielding madman allegedly upset after he was denied a happy ending following a massage at a spa. The man can be seen on surveillance camera attacking an employee at the Tao Spa Bodywork in Queens. He reportedly demanded a refund after a female masseuse declined to perform sexual favors following his foot massage. The 54-year-old masseuse refused to give a refund, and the unidentified man lost it, attacking the masseuse and swinging a hammer at another employee. The employees reportedly gave the man $40 before he smashed the piggy bank on the counter and left with the money inside. The suspect remains at large. Those were today's top crime stories. I'm Anthony Velez for the Daily Debrief.
Back to testimony now in the case against the three officers accused of covering up a deadly Chicago police shooting. The state's star witness is Officer Dora Fontaine, who claims the three defendants twisted her words in their official reports. Here, Officer Fontaine testified about what she saw when the shots rang out.
Did you know he had a knife?
He had a shiny object, and I've seen knives before.
And you say he was swaying a knife?
Yes.
And what do you mean by that?
Swaying left to right.
Okay. As he was swaying this knife, could you see him clearly?
Yes.
Did you ever see him raise the knife up to his shoulder?
No.
Did you see him raise the knife above his chest?
No.
Did you see him attack anyone with the knife?
No.
Did you see him touch anyone with the knife?
No.
Did he hold the knife near or below his waist?
Yes.
As you were getting out of your car, could you still see this individual known as Laquan McDonald?
Yes.
Could you hear anything?
Drop the knife and gunshots.
All right. Besides drop the knife and gunshots, did you see anything else?
Puffs of smoke.
Where were these puffs of smoke?
They were coming from the location of Laquan.
Did you know who was saying drop the knife?
No.
Next, Officer Fontaine explained some of the words prosecutors say the defendants put in her mouth in subsequent police reports.
Did you ever observe Laquan McDonald raise his arm towards Officer Van Dyke?
No.
Did you ever observe Laquan McDonald raise his arm as if attacking Van Dyke?
No.
Did you make that statement to Defendant March?
No.
Is that statement false based on what you witnessed of the shooting?
Objection, Your Honor.
That calls for a conclusion, so yes. That is sustained.
Didn't interrupt your objection. Did Defendant March ever give you an opportunity to review or revise this report before it was submitted?
No.
That's the answer.
That's a rule.
Let's move along now to an independent witness in this case who testified that he was ordered away from the scene. Eventually, he came forward and spoke out.
Well, the reason why I came forward was because the following morning, after the day after the incident, I turned on the news. I wanted to see if there was anything on the news about the shooting. And when I heard the police spokesperson say that he was lunging, that Laquan McDonald was lunging at the police. And when I found out that all he had was a knife, I told my wife at that moment, I'm like, they're lying. This is not what happened.
So what did you do next?
I discussed it with my wife and she was kind of worried for me to step forward. I told her I had to say something because I can't. This is just like a burden on my shoulders, and it's eating away at me.
Attorney Mike Korobanics is back with us tonight here on the Daily Debrief. So, Mike, this independent witness gets waved away from the scene. Why not take his statement right there? I mean, shouldn't that be the way police operate?
Absolutely. I mean, here you have someone who's an independent witness in a very important case. Anytime there's a shooting by a police officer, it's an important case. Whether to determine it's justified or not, you would want a witness there who has no connection. The very fact that they told him to get away from the scene and directed him away to make, I think he said, a U-turn, really does not fare well for the defendants in this case, because it seems like the beginning of the cover-up.
And you think that witness came across very well?
Oh, I thought he was very credible.
Okay, so Dora Fontaine, the officer who's the key witness here, basically saying that the reports don't match what I saw at the scene. Is it evidence of a cover-up, or is it that the detectives, that some of the other officers on trial here, were relying on people who saw things differently?
Well, this is a witness that this is where it becomes a chess match. Now, do you really have to, if you don't win a sufficiency of evidence argument, you really need to put your client on to explain why her statements were in his report?
It'll be really interesting. If one of these defendants take the stand, that will be really interesting. Mike Korobanics, appreciate your insight here on The Debrief, as always.
Thank you for having me, Ty.
All right, that's all the time we have for today on The Daily Debrief. A reminder that our live coverage of cases around the country will resume tomorrow starting at 9 a.m. here on the Law and Crime Network. And of course, I'll see you from 5 to 5:30, as always, here on The Daily Debrief. From all of us at Law and Crime, have a good evening. We'll see you tomorrow.
My name is Sam Weich. About a year ago, I had a heart transplant. My life was saved on the last day that I was supposed to be on this planet. I don't know who my donor was, but that person saved my life. And now I know what a miracle feels like. It feels terrific. Having a new heart's given me time to spend more time with my loved ones, watching them grow up. That new heart gave me a new mission in life, and that is to get others to sign up to be organ and tissue donors. The most common thing I hear when I ask people why they haven't signed up is, I don't know, I just haven't thought about it. Well, why don't you think about it? Think about the life you might save or the life you might enhance. Over 130 million people have already signed up to be an organ, eye, or tissue donor. They're men and women, all ages, all races, and they have one thing in common. They want to save lives. Please sign up to be an organ, eye, and tissue donor. You don't want to miss your chance to save a life.
Hey everyone, I'm Jesse Weber, and this is Legal News You Can Use. The internet can be a complicated place for many different reasons, but one of the questions that seems to always confuse people is, can I use a photo or image that I find online? Let's discuss. Okay, so first, copyrights. Copyrights are all the exclusive rights that someone has in an original work that he or she created, including images. How they're distributed, seen, copied, and otherwise used is up to the copyright owner. Generally, if you created the image, you automatically own the copyright in it. Pretty cool, right? What this means is that you usually need the permission of the copyright owner before using the image. However, ask yourself the following. Are you planning to use the image sparingly, or maybe only a portion of it? Are you not going to make money off of it? Are you using it in a news reporting, educational, or scholarly context that benefits the public? Are you completely changing the image so it's unrecognizable? Are you transforming the meaning of the image, like using it in a parody? Is it impossible to get the permission of the copyright owner? Well, if your answer is yes to some or all of these questions, then you may be able to use it without permission, but that's not always guaranteed. Also, sometimes images no longer are copyright protected, meaning they're in the public domain, or the owner grants something called a Creative Commons license, allowing others to freely use the image in specific ways. There are websites that offer royalty-free stock images as well. You should look into all that too. Copyrights aside, if the image features a logo or slogan, or a person, particularly a celebrity, then other issues could come into play as well, including trademark, privacy, and right of publicity laws. I told you, complicated. So best practice is to get permission or give credit whenever you can before using an image, particularly on social media. For more legal news you can use, go to longcrime.com.
Can I go to the sleepover?
Lucy, I want you to promise me something. If there's any drinking, I want you to say, no thanks, not my thing.
Mom!
I promise you, your real friends won't care. Deal?
I promise, Mom.
They really do hear you.
Did you pack your toothbrush?
For tips on how to start the talk, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov. A public service message from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration.
Do you know the signs of a brain aneurysm? The worst headache of your life? Pain behind one eye? Dizziness or blurry vision? Don't ignore it. Seek immediate emergency care. The Lisa Calagrassi Foundation. Learn more at lisafoundation.org.